It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. You know, it's kind of a Mississippi Sunday morning, too, in case you guys over there think I'm not thinking about you. I am. And you folks in Georgia who are listening, and certainly you folks in Northwest Florida, it's kind of our region here, influenced by that big flywheel, the Gulf of Mexico, that keeps bringing those tropical conditions back into Alabama, which has made Alabama and much of Mississippi and Northwest Florida and much of Georgia this incredibly stable environment for a long, long time, thousands of years, much more so than much of the rest of the country, which was hit by ice ages. I think about that sometimes when it gets really hot and think, you know, this good old Gulf, it's been good to us. It's been good to us. It's hurricane season. It's time for thinking about a lot of things in your garden. And I think a lot about gardening, and does it make sense? And does it make sense to grow your own vegetables? And I look at farming, and I think, boy, we're in trouble with farming in Alabama. We got, in fact, throughout the United States right now, it's a really serious problem. And farmers have, a lot of farmers are going to struggle. And I work with a lot of them. I still do. It was my first job. One of my first jobs growing up. Well, my first job was actually picking up hay bales. That was the first time I actually got paid to do something. I don't think I was worth much doing it, but, you know, you learn young. Pruning apple orchards, one of my second jobs. By the time I was out of high school, I was scouting cotton. I knew a little bit. I could just figure out the chemistry. I was pretty good at looking at bugs. I was pretty good at understanding plants. And right my senior year in high school, my junior and senior year in high school, and then my first year in college, working in cotton fields. I'm not saying I was super good at it. I'm ashamed of myself sometimes for not being better at it. But I learned a lot. And I learned a lot about farming, and I learned a lot about what works, and I really now can sympathize with a lot of farmers who are struggling. Let me talk about one of the interesting things in farming, and we could spend the whole hour talking about it, and I'm not, but it's something for you to think about, is that basically farmers are in trouble because there are only four crops in Alabama, maybe five. When it comes to field row agriculture, we're basically talking about soybeans. We're talking about corn. We're talking about cotton. Cotton is in terrible shape, and people who are doing cotton are having a real struggle. It reminds me a lot of the time when I was in cotton, when much of the price of cotton that farmers got was supported by the federal government. And it's, if we're going to have cotton farming, that's probably going to happen again. Does that make sense? I don't know. You know, one of the reasons we're stuck on these three crops, these three field row crops, is because the equipment that it takes to do things now is so expensive that basically you can't buy equipment to do anything else, and you got to pay off your equipment that you have, and so you don't want to get off the treadmill of corn, soybeans, and cotton. You don't want to experiment with new things. The other big ones are poultry, and then somewhere way down the line is cattle, because people have a hard time making money on cattle in the long run in Alabama, but we'll put it in there. But what does that mean for gardening? Well, it's interesting to me because we don't have other crops that we're growing We're not the farmers in Alabama are not Alabama's breadbasket. They're not America's breadbasket. They're exporting soybeans and corn to other places. They may be feeding poultry in some cases if they're close to poultry slaughterhouses. That's really the way it has to work. But we're not doing that. We're not feeding the public. And I was thinking about this the other day when it came to things. And it's not the farmer's fault. It's basically the way everything got consolidated. And they're struggling to have a market. And they're struggling with just a few crops. And I'm thinking about this the other day because people locally have gotten really wild and crazy in various parts of Alabama about Mennonite and Amish vegetables. So if the Mennonites open a vegetable store, boy, you got people coming from all over to take advantage of that. Now, it's interesting. The Mennonites, I'm not sure that the Mennonite produce is any better than any place else. It's just there. It's at a reasonable price. It's not organic. I mean, they're using pesticides in most cases. They're using tons of plastic. It's all, you know, it's as modern as anything else, but they're growing vegetables. And I kind of have a thing. I suspect that people actually want to eat something. They want to eat something, and there's some value in that. And so no matter how people talk about, oh, does your garden make sense, I'm going to tell you, your garden makes sense if you want to eat something. And this is a good time to think about what you're going to eat. I want to talk a little bit about that this morning. I want to talk a lot about how to cook it, because I think that's one of the impediments to growing vegetables, is that people get all this stuff and they don't really know what to do with it. And they don't know how to manage it from the garden back into the kitchen. I'm still learning. There's a lot to learn. There's a lot to figure out. And every meal can be a way of sort of figuring out, gosh, how am I going to do this time? Can I do this better? It's fun. David Hubble does that. He's great. Hope we'll get to talk to him soon about some of his vegetables that he grows. We're going to talk to you a little bit about some of yours. I want to get you started, because it's now time in North Alabama to begin putting out vegetables for winter, like broccoli and cabbage. And this isn't to say sowing them up there. This is to say getting them in the garden. And you could sow some things. Probably not too late to sow some beets. Certainly not too late to sow some radishes, which are great fall radishes. You call me if you don't know what that means, but this is a great time. And in South Alabama as well, it's now time for you to begin sowing those vegetables in pots, so that you'll be ready to put them out a little later in September. It's now time. It's getting late. Do it as soon as possible. Broccoli, cabbage, all of those winter vegetables. Now's to kale, your collards in particular. Get ready for your mustard greens. Go ahead and get those mustard greens sown. And let's talk about it, and particularly the big purple ones. It's that time. You got a great week to do it. The cool weather that's coming up next week throughout the entire state should inspire you. It will inspire your garden. It's a good time to put things out into the garden and watch them come up. Might need to water them just a little bit as it dries out during hurricane summer, in between the tropical storms and the big major fronts that come in. The front came in. It's now going to be dry. The wind's going to be out of the northeast, and it's going to be a very pleasant time to work in the garden. Let's talk about that this morning, and let's talk about cooking. We're going to do that. I think that's going to be a really fun thing to do. And you can give us a call, 251-343-0106, 251-343-0106. Maybe we even talk a little bit about farming. I think it's an interesting thing to do. Maybe how we could think about a new kind of farming in Alabama that makes us less dependent on whether China buys our soybeans.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. You know, it is the time we need to begin thinking about getting stuff planted. And it makes sense to do it. There's a learning curve. There's a learning curve when it comes to deciding when to plant, what you're going to plant for food. You're not just growing a vegetable garden. You're growing food. And how to pick it. And I find that's a big problem for folks. Because, you know, if you do your garden right, you're actually going to end up generally with more food than you can actually use yourself. Even if you have a small garden. Even if you have a small place. It's amazing how much food you can pull in from your backyard when you do it right. You need sunlight. You need good soil, and we can talk about that. But you can do some amazing things. You can do some amazing things with just what you have in your backyard. We're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to talk about how to use it. We're going to talk about when to pick it, how to cook it, as the show goes on. So stay tuned. We have some questions this morning. This is an interesting question. I'm not sure where this came from. I'll have to think about it. It's a question from a listener. I live in Zone 9 north of Mobile and own over 30 macrophylla hydrangeas. I routinely cover them in winter when the temp goes below 32 degrees. Now, hold on. Let me say right there, the worst thing you could probably do for your hydrangeas is to cover them when the temperature goes below 32 degrees. You're actually going to make them more vulnerable to cold. Let me just say, do not do that. You want those hydrangeas to settle in to freezing temperatures and to be used to that. And it will not hurt them at all. We have nowhere in Alabama do people routinely cover their hydrangeas. And it's just not a thing. It's not something you should do under any circumstance. Let's talk about it. And the person also notes, look, I drove through some poor areas of the city where people have had these old hydrangeas that they didn't get from, you know, I can guarantee you they didn't get them from Home Depot or Lowe's. And they're doing just fine. And they're blooming great. And yeah, that's a lesson. It's the type of hydrangea you get can be very important in how it blooms, whether it blooms again. I would say that a lot of the newfangled hydrangeas on the market are probably designed for Ohio, designed for New Jersey, where it gets much colder and where, in fact, there may be some benefit in covering your hydrangeas. Not sure, but maybe. So variety matters, and you should get the right variety. But under no circumstance, under any circumstance, would it make sense to cover your hydrangeas when the temperature goes below 32. We've had a problem with hydrangeas because there have been sudden shifts in temperature, and that can damage buds. That can damage buds. But in many cases, those buds will recover. The plant will recover. You're going to get lots of plants. And it's really hard to predict. So here's what you want to do. It's not the cold. There's never going to be. It's not because of a cold temperature that we cause that you would ever see a problem with hydrangeas in Alabama. It's because there was a sudden shift between very warm temperatures where the plant had not gone dormant and very cold temperatures. And so it basically had too much gas in the tank when the cold spell came. It had too much water in the stem. And it hadn't actually developed the sugars that it needs to protect itself from freezing temperatures. So what you want to do is when you get those first 32 degree temperatures, you definitely, when it gets cold, you definitely want to expose your hydrangea to that. You definitely want that to be exposed. If we were to go from, say, 85 degrees to 20 degrees on the first cold spell of the year, there could be an advantage to covering them for one night. That one night, you might do that, and you might see an advantage. But let's don't go there, because it's too difficult to predict that. It's just too hard. And hydrangeas have been doing well here for a long, long time without a lot of folderol. Some years have better blooms than others. That's the way plants work. But don't cover your hydrangeas. Just don't. It just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. You want them to go dormant. You want them to lose their leaves. You want them to lose their leaves in November, December, if they lose their leaves to whatever. But just get them dormant and leave them alone. There it is. Let's see. What else we got? We got a caller. Kathy, I'm listening. What's up?
Oh, hi. Good morning, Bill. Yes, my name's Kathy. I talked to you earlier in the year regarding an eastern red cedar I have, and you had suggested to take it out. And I'm getting ready to do that. And so I wanted to get your suggestions about how to go about doing this.
All right, Kathy, just remind me, where is the cedar in relationship to your house and to your yard? Tell me where it is.
Okay,
tell me how big it is.
I'm in Fairhope, and it's in direct sunlight. It's about maybe 5 feet from the house, and it's above my roof line. So it's about 15 feet high, I'm guessing.
Yeah, okay, good. And the diameter is maybe the size of it's a little bigger than a broom handle, say, at the base?
Yes, it's about 5 to 6 inches wide on the stem of the tree.
Yeah, right at the base. Yeah.
Okay.
So good. Yeah, I would definitely say 5 feet from your house, you need to go ahead and cut it out. Just cut it down. Here's the thing about cedars. They're not going to resprout. That's the good news. So you don't have to worry about that.
Okay.
Just cut it as low as possible. Will it be possible to dig the roots out? Yes, probably, but there's really not much need to at that size.
Okay.
Just leave it there. Just leave it there. You want to cut that stump as low as possible. So you can, just to make it easier on yourself, go ahead and cut go up about a foot and a half, 18 inches, and cut it off. And then take the saw, whatever you use. If you don't want to use a chainsaw, that's small enough, you can use a handsaw, and just cut it as low to the ground as you possibly can.
Okay.
And that way you won't notice it, and it won't be a problem. You can't plant a plant right exactly in that place, but you'll be able to plant all around it. And I wouldn't even worry about digging it up, because it's not going to resprout.
Okay. Now, that was one of my questions about how to pull it up and how deep was the root. So that solves that problem. Okay.
Yes. No. So the root will be, the root could be a little bit of a problem to dig up. You could do it, but there's really no need to. And it just plant around it. It's not taking up a lot of space, and it's not really gonna cause any harm.
Okay, good. Any suggestions what to plant in its place? Like I said, it's in full sun.
Yeah, full sun, and it's about 5 feet from your house, which is a good, which is about the right distance to plant a good shrub. There are many shrubs that you could plant there. I don't know. We're going to come back. Kathy, hold on. Let's take a break. Okay. We're going to come right back.
Okay.
Along about 1825, I left Tennessee very much alive. And I never would have got through the Arkansas mud if I hadn't been a-ruddin' that Tennessee stud.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. We've got Kathy is asking about a cedar. And so we've gotten to the point where we know we can cut the cedar without any problems. It's small cedar. It's only about 15 feet tall. It's 5 feet from the house, which means it's going to be an increasing problem for the house. Let me ask you, so it's always good to say, what can I do with this plant besides just fill a gap? Does this plant have any other use? And I can't tell you what that other use is without knowing a little bit more about your yard, but there are things to think about. It's fun to think about. Let's say you're getting lots of sunlight, and let's say, I don't know, but let's say your house is, let's say this side of your house is facing west. Well, if you've got a lot of windows on that side of the house, you might want something that actually keeps the sunlight from coming into those windows during these hot days in August and September. So you could plant something a little taller. On the other hand, you might say, gosh, you know, I really want to have an edible garden. I want something really neat here. So what could I plant there? Or you might say, oh, I need some flowers, or I need it to work with the plants on either side. So there's a lot of questions that I can't answer about the specifics, but there's many cool things you could do there based on all of that. And so I'm just going to start here. And none of this is, you'll just give you a little smorgasbord of things that you can think about and think about how many ways can I make this plant serve my interest here? So let's say that's probably going to be a really good spot for rosemary. And rosemary will do really well. The fact that the cedar's growing there suggests to me that it's probably not sopping wet. It's probably fairly well drained. Actually, the cedar will have actually made that soil a little bit more alkaline. Oddly enough, cedars do that. Just a little bit. And so if you can dig up and put a couple of rosemaries there. They're really beautiful. They're evergreen. You can use them they flower. You can use them to collect. You can get rosemary and put it in your, as my wife does, in her bread. You can put it in your vegetables. You can use it in lots of different ways. You can just bring it in the house and smell it. Rosemary would be a great little thing to put there, and it would do really well. There's many other shrubs that would love full sun. Everything from what we call red bottle brush would tolerate full sun there. A little, eat 5 feet from the house. If it's truly 5 feet from the house, come out just a little bit more, and you could plant something like a kumquat. Which is also very beautiful. It's evergreen. It has fruits. It has beautiful flowers. I think about that sometimes. Yes. So all those things. And then you could, if you wanted to, have a theme there, and you could plant a kumquat with a couple of rosemaries on either side of it, which would be really quite beautiful. And then you've got a little edible spot.
Okay. Would a tea olive be okay there?
A tea olive could work there. It would work. It might. It's it would probably work okay there. It would be just fine. Tea olives are going to spread. So if I planted a tea olive, I would plant it out about 6 feet. I would plant it no closer than 6 feet from the house.
Okay.
And maybe just a little farther out. Tea olives are great. They're wonderful. They are tolerant of full sun. They like a little bit more of a moist situation, and they actually tolerate a little bit of shade too. But tea olives would work there, yes.
Okay. Okay, that gives me a good start, and I can go ahead and get started as far as like getting this tree out, you know, in the fall, and get something going there.
All right, Kathy.
Great.
Good to hear from you. Keep us posted.
Thanks so much for all your help.
All right. Bye. Yeah, okay. So let's see. What else? Is it too late to put out old hay for mulch? For new dirt for fall. Yeah, you know, it might not decompose entirely, but this is not a bad time. It depends on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to plant fall vegetables, I think having a mulch with old hay can be a good thing. There's a couple of things that you need to think about with hay, and unfortunately, this is where we are in the world. I don't mean for things to be this way. If you have hay, please make sure that it was not taken from a pasture where they used a herbicide like Grazon or other herbicides that are sprayed over the grasses to kill broadleaf plants. Now, broccoli is a broadleaf plant. Tomatoes are a broadleaf plant. Cabbage is a broadleaf plant. Most everything you grow in your yard is going to be a broadleaf plant. So if you use that hay and it came from a pasture where herbicides like Grazon were used, you could run into big problems. And several of our listeners have called in to tell me, oh man, what a mess. I lost my tomatoes, and we've discussed this. It can be really bad if you use that. So make sure when you get hay that it comes from a place that did not use a herbicide like Grazon, which will be persistent in the hay. It will be. It just is. That's the first thing. Second thing is, the old hay is the best because it won't have many weed seeds. So you want to look at that. I do think usually with hay, if you put it on thick enough, the weed seeds generally don't germinate. They generally don't germinate because they're buried. But if you ever turn that soil, those weed seeds may come to the top. So, for example, if you use Bermuda hay, oh God, how am I supposed to say that? Bermuda hay. You could get weed seeds that are very difficult to deal with. So be careful with hay. I use hay, and I have some really old hay. I mean, I'm talking about hay that was cut probably, 10, 20 years ago that just kind of got left around, and I've used it, and it's really good. And I don't really have a problem with weed seeds, and there wasn't much Bermuda grass in that hay, and it works pretty well. You know, that's the caution with hay. If the hay meets all these other requirements, can you use it on a vegetable bed this time of year? Yes, I think it's very beneficial. It can be very beneficial because it's going to keep the soil cooler. Even if it doesn't become soil itself, it's going to keep the soil cooler. It's going to begin breaking down on the undersides, and all of that helps. I'm just going to leave it at that. And then you can plant your plants in between. I would, if it's like a square bale, you can just take little pieces of that, you know, little 1-inch thick pieces of that square bale, pull it off in little squares and just lay it there, and then plant your plants in between the rows of that hay, and it works, can work pretty well. It can be pretty beneficial this time of year, even if it doesn't break down immediately. So all that caution about hay, I've got to say, hay can be very useful. It can be very useful, but there's a lot of caveats in using it. There's a lot of things you need to think about before you use it. And the new problem, graze-on herbicides, it's a big one. It's a huge one. And you really have to know where your hay is coming from before you use it. Sorry, there it is. Johnny sent me a picture of his garden. It is looking great. And you know, one of the interesting things, Johnny and I, we've been watching his orange trees gradually recovering this year. And if Johnny had given up on these, cut him back in May, he might not have seen what he's seeing now, which is that he's going to have some orange trees. They may even produce fruit next year if the winter is not too cold this year. It's very interesting and quite useful to think about how to do this. Some orange and citrus trees, if your sprouts are coming from the first 6 inches, from the first 12 inches, 8 to 12 inches, more than likely, those sprouts need to be cut back. Even if that's the only sprouts you have, they need to be cut back. You've got a problem there. So remove those sprouts in the first 8 to 12 inches. Johnny's already done that. His citrus is looking good. His tree is sprouting from above 18 inches on the trunk, and it's got prolific sprouting that's occurring, and I think that tree is going to shape up really, really nicely. It looks good. Looks really good, Johnny. So call me about your citrus if you're still having some concerns about it. This is the time of year when people are going to need to think about their citrus. If you're seeing three leaves, clusters of three leafed, like the leaves are tightly clustered in groups of three, that's a warning sign on your citrus. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about what it means. Let's talk about what you should do. You give me a call. let's see. Yeah, so it's sending me a picture of deep run roots by Vivian Howard. I don't know much about it, but how to use vegetables in the garden from Ultra Runner. It's, you know, I do want to talk about this. Gardens are not like grocery stores in a really good way, and in some ways that you probably don't think about. So people say, oh, I'm going to leave these vegetables on here until I need them, because I don't need them right now. And this is the time of year, if we're getting plenty of rain, where you're going to get a ton of produce, more than you can use. So what are you going to do? Well, with a lot of vegetables like beans, like squash, you need to go ahead and pick them, even if you don't use them. And we'll come back and talk about that.
Sugar magnolia, blossoms blooming, that's all empty and I don't care.
So my baby down by the river,
wishing I could come up soon for care.
You get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 1065.
All right, where are we? So, Amy, I didn't realize that was you who sent me the message about the mulch. So I know that Amy knows about hay, so sorry for going over that again. But it was good for everybody else, right? Hay is an interesting issue now because of the kinds of things we add to pastures in terms of herbicides that are easily taken up by the hay. What effect does that have on the cows who eat the hay and the horses who eat the hay? I don't know. We probably won't know for another 10 or 15 years when we, if we actually have any funding left to do science on studying those kinds of things. Maybe we'll see it show up in people and then we'll know better. But here's the thing with that peanut hay. So Amy's using peanut hay, which she didn't let me know, but now she did. So peanut hay is very different, and it is being grown. And Johnny, that may be seeing what you're seeing more of too. I don't know if we've seen an increase in production of peanuts. Some of it is going into the hay, not into the peanuts anymore, which is kind of weird. But it's like peanuts are becoming a kind of alfalfa crop, which is used for premium things like horses, where people pay more than, you know, if you can afford a horse, I guess you could afford to pay for premium hay. So what effect is that going to have on the garden? I really don't know. But I can tell you a couple of things. One, it will break down much more quickly. And in the process, you're going to lose a lot of the benefits of that hay. In part because it does break down so quickly. Because it has a little more nitrogen, has a little more inherent nitrogen, and so it's going to be more easily broken down into soil. But that also means that a lot of the soil benefits are going to be lost just to outgassing to the atmosphere. And I have other words for that, but we'll just call it that for the time being. And it's all the soil creatures breaking it down, and it's on the surface, and they're going to break it down quickly, and you're going to lose, not only you're going to lose the material itself, but you're also going to lose a lot of nitrogen. What would be ideal is if you could, I think, take that peanut hay, assuming that it doesn't have any chemical problems, and there's a lot of chemicals that go into peanut production, even when it comes to the hay, I expect. But assuming there are no chemical problems, if I would put the peanut hay down first and then put something over it, like maybe leaves, if you could find any leaves that would help there. And you won't need as many leaves, but just a little bit to keep so that it ties up a little bit of that nitrogen that you would lose, and you get a little bit more organic matter. It's going to speed up the whole organic process of breaking it down in the soil even more quickly. Amy, I made this too hard, but you asked me, and I hadn't thought about peanut hay before. I'm thinking about it now. I think I'm mostly right about it breaking down very quickly, maybe too quickly. But give it a shot. Let's see what happens. All right. Roland, let's see if we can get this in before we have to take a big break. Tell me what you want to talk about azaleas.
Yes, sir. I live in an older home. Built in the late 60s, and I would have to guess that these azaleas across the front were planted back then. They're, I don't know, 5 feet tall. I keep the tops trimmed. My yard is crowned up. It doesn't even look like a two-story home if you just ride by and glance. So it's hard to keep them straight, as my wife wants me to keep them straight. And she wants me to cut them back. Just cut, you know, like two or three.
And then what?
Like I said, they're.
And then what?
I don't know. See if they grow back.
Yeah, that's a good question.
But this because they're. I don't think leggy is a good word to use for azaleas. But you know, the growth, the green, is the last couple of feet, and it's just a bunch of.
Right. Well, leggy is a great word to use for azaleas. So let's think about this.
But it would be, if I was going to cut them back at all, it'd be January, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I wouldn't do it in January. I think I would probably do it in late February. You could do it, and you could even do it in April. I wouldn't do it now. But here's the most important thing. I don't think you're going to accomplish what you want to accomplish. If you cut them back, you need to cut them all the way back, all the way to the ground, to within 6 inches.
Okay.
And understand that they're going to grow back, and depending on what kind they are, they may grow back very quickly, and they may get very big again. But at least that will give you a chance to control that growth a little bit, and that means you're going to be out pruning pretty regularly. For most azaleas, and particularly our classic Southern Indian azaleas,
that's what I've got. One encore somewhere mixed in that somebody planted. I don't know who, and then the rest of them are just the traditional.
And they're 6 foot tall azaleas, and you're never going to keep them from being 6 to 8 foot tall azaleas. They
Bill,
will always be 6 to.
Bill, I've noticed a couple of the larger offshoots or whatever. Are dying or dead? Not a great amount, but
yeah,
you know, there's some it's mixed in there that are just dead.
Yeah, and that's right, and that's so that happens to older plants because that's why you need to cut them back to the ground. Let me just say that no matter if you're going to cut them back, cut them all the way back to the ground. They get a stem rot, and it's a kind of a crown and stem rot on the older stems. And it only happens after about 15 or 20 years. And at 15 to 20 years, you start getting an increase in that. And you can resolve that. You can eliminate it entirely by simply cutting them all the way back to the ground till they're about 6 inches, till you've only got about 6 inches above the ground.
Well,
and what you're getting, those new sprouts won't have that. Plus, now how far away from the house are these azaleas?
Oh, man, two, 3 foot. They're right on.
There's no way you're ever going to be happy with these azaleas.
I'd love to re-landscape, but I don't, you know, we're retired, and I don't have $5,000 or $6,000 to.
No, you don't need that. So let's just think about, you can certainly cut them down, but long term, you're going to want those azaleas to be farther away from the house because it's going to be very hard to maintain an 8 foot tall and 8 foot wide azalea when it's only 2 feet from the house. You see the problem?
I'm having to lean across them now with a hedger and get a ladder in some places and lean across. Yeah, it's pretty rough.
Yeah. Roland, if you'll hold on, let me think about this during the break, and let's see if we can, let's try to figure out what you're going to do.
All right, man.
And I'll keep on praying with two dirty hands. I'm living, yes, living in the garden.
It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
No, lots of things to talk about, lots of things to follow up on. Amy, if we don't get to talk about hay, and let's talk about it more. I think, you know, can we commercialize mulch? and that's a big thing. We've commercialized it through the pine bark industry, but that's got some issues now. Not with the quality of the pine bark, but the quantity of pine bark. And there are many reasons for that. So, you know, I've often thought, is it possible to even grow a premium mulch for gardens? Probably. Is it economical? I don't know. That remains to be seen. Nobody's doing that. So how do you do it? Let me just say, folks, the best mulch you have is not going to be a mulch that's made out of just one kind of thing. If you don't use herbicides in your yard, your garden clippings are an incredible mulch. They make an incredible mulch. Amy, if you can learn to see when you have a lot of vegetative growth coming up in your pasture and you want to clip it because you're getting, say, too much goldenrod or too much other things, that can be a really great hay. Things like goldenrod, which can be a problem in pastures, they make a great mulch. They make a great mulch if you can figure out how to get them on your plants. And I use them all the time, and they break down relatively quickly. There's still plenty of structural stuff there because of those stems that actually improves the texture of the soil. If things break down too quickly, you don't improve the texture and the water holding ability of the soil. And so it's a trade-off, but goldenrod is great if you can. Those are some of the best things. And so look around. If it's got seeds on it already, it might not be a good idea to use it as mulch. But earlier in the year, things like goldenrod before they actually flower, great. Mare's tails before they flower, great. What kind of problems have you got in your pasture? And so it's an interesting thing about it. What kind of problems have you got in your yard that you can use? You know, if you've got elderberries and you just need to cut them, use them as mulch. They're great. They're wonderful. Now, the stems, they can sprout. So you got to think about that, but you can use the foliage. You can use the vines, too, that you have in your yard if you use them judiciously. You can certainly use the leaves of many plants. Think about that mulch. Anyway, David Hubble's going to be with us, I think, at 10:30, unless something gets in the way. And David's always got some great ideas about cooking. I'm going to talk a little bit more about cooking. But meanwhile, Roland, are you still there?
Yes, sir.
So here's what I would do. Yeah, here's what I would do. You.
Now, do you want me to send pictures?
No, I can see it already. I can see it in my head.
Oh, yeah.
So listen. Here's the thing. You want your retirement to be you want it to be pleasant, and you don't want those azaleas to be a pain in your patootie, mm-hmm. your entire retirement. So. Let's just start thinking about this a little piece at a time. You could propagate the plants you have if you were really interested by taking a branch and layering it out, taking one branch and stretching it out and layering it about 3 to 4 feet in front of the plant you already have. In that case, you would have enough space for that azalea to spread. You still may not like the height, but you would at least have room for it to spread.
Now, how would you? You just clip a branch and plant it?
No, what you would do is you want to take a live branch. You want to take a live branch that's living, still connected to the plant. You're going to lean that branch over, and you're going to scuffle the ground a little bit underneath it. You're going to lay that branch in the ground. You're going to scar it just a little bit where it touches the ground. Scar it with your fingernail even. That's fine. Just on one side. Bury it under the dirt and let the leaves emerge at the tip, and it'll root.
I got you. Okay. Hey, there's more to the story.
Yeah?
I have 6 15-foot Japanese yews that are spaced out between the windows and, of course, between the azaleas, and they are about 1 foot from the house.
Oh, Roland, what a nightmare. So
you don't even know what a nightmare it is.
The one thing I would say about the turn your radio down behind you, I think it might be. Have you got your radio on?
I don't have a radio on, nothing.
It must be coming. Yeah, okay, good. It's coming from the station. Listen, what I would... What I would suggest with the ewes.
Drop back and
is,
punt.
Yeah, no. They're going to grow back very slowly. And cutting them back, you'll either kill them, which you probably won't, or they'll grow back very slowly. So you actually, you know, by the time they reach that annoying size, you'll have at least a few years of relief.
Oh, they're right up under the soffit. They're right up under the soffit board of the hunt.
Yeah, so go ahead and cut.
I try to keep them there. So they're tall.
Yeah, cut them back. I think you can. If you like.
2.5, 3 foot.
No, you'd probably want to cut them back to the ground.
Oh, really?
I don't think they're going to recover. Yeah. Let me. I'll check on that. I don't know how well they're going to sprout. I've seen ewes resprout. Let's think about that. If you're, I mean, are you having to spend a lot of time pruning those ewes?
Every couple of 3 months, yes, sir. And I'm getting to the point where I'm going to have to rent a man basket to do them properly. It's kind of hard to do from.
If you lost the ewes. If you lost the ewes, would you care?
I would not. I could cut
them
down
to the wife...
pump and put some imazapyr or something on them and where they won't come back. And
doesn't that sound like a good idea?
It does to me. And it would to my wife. It would to my wife. I really kind of wanted some ammo so I could... tell her.
Yeah, so it's good. Just cut the ewes down. The azaleas are always going to be a problem. If you're going to cut them, well.
That's the info I got. She wants me to kind of like do it today, and I've been telling her that you can't do that.
Well, you could, and if you didn't care much about them,
Yeah.
You could do it. To be honest, you could do it. It just may make the azaleas more vulnerable to freeze damage, and you'll probably lose your flowers. So, if you do it in March, for example, which would be a good time, or February, in March, you'd have a chance for them to bloom, and then you could cut them back, and they wouldn't suffer any freeze damage from rapid regrowth. But you could probably do it now and they'd probably be okay. You just won't get any flowers next year.
Right. How quickly will they come back from a 6-inch stump? Or, you know, not a stump.
I guarantee you 4 feet the first year. And probably more like 5.
You're kidding me.
No.
Well, I guess you aren't. No. Okay, then.
I wouldn't say this out loud in front of all these people if I thought it was wrong.
Right.
I've seen it happen a lot.
I cut them down 6 inches in March, and in June I'll have 4 or 5 foot plants again.
Well, give it August.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Earl.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Questions on conservation, natural history, and gardening? Talk with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, a little cleanup here real quick. Amy, goldenrod is goldenrod. You know it. It's great mulch. Mare's tail is not what's on your horses. It's the old name for coniza, which is sometimes called horse's tail, which is also not on your horses, but grows in the pasture. And I'm sure you have some. It should be flowering right about now. got these little white fuzzy flowers all over a big head. All that's good mulch, not necessarily while it's flowering, but earlier in the year. It could be used even while it's flowering if you can get it before it goes to seed. But all that's really good. So we'll come back and talk more about that and more about this mulch. I did say we were going to talk about vegetables today, and I want to do that. Listen, folks, it's time to plant vegetables for your winter garden. There's so many of them to talk about. I don't know where to start. I have them arranged here in front of me just to remind me of what I got to do. I got to get parsley planted. I got to get these. Oh, I'm going to try this new purple lady bok choy. I'm going to try that this year. It looks pretty. We're going to see whether I actually like the flavor of it. I've got a new perpetual spinach that I'm trying. Got a couple of kinds of perpetual spinach, which are basically chard. When you see that perpetual spinach, that's what you're looking at. I've got all sorts of cabbage I'm trying. I got a new collard called Mini Mizell. I don't know how that's going to do. I'm certainly going to plant fennel. John Olive and I are both enthusiastic about fennel. It's really a great thing to grow in the garden. I got these Dragon F1 fennels in front of me that I'm trying this year. I've got a new kale called Sahara. I have no idea that it's going to be better than the other great kales that I've been planting all along. I got all kind of broccolis. I've got Gypsy. I've got Umpqua. I've got Gemini. I've got Waltham 29. I've got Marathon. I've got Brussels sprouts. I've got, what else have I got? I got cilantro. Man, this is, we're coming up on the great cilantro season. If you've been really frustrated with cilantros, now's the time to do it. I've got arugula. Arugula is a great thing. These are just the things that I'm planning for fall and that will carry me through fall. And I should never forget that I've got tons and tons of radishes. What a great thing those radishes are. And we're going to start planting those. But meanwhile, I'm harvesting all this other stuff. I got okra coming out the ears. What do you do with okra? And, you know, here's the thing. You don't just say, oh, okay, well, I don't need okra today. I'm just going to leave it on the okra stalk. Well, you know what happens? You get these really long okra that you can't utilize because it gets hard and tough and it's starting to produce seeds. And not only that, it sort of sends a signal to the plant, okay, you're done. You've done your duty. You've produced seeds for the year. You can now turn off and go to sleep. Huh? And then you lose your okra. So what you do is when you get those big okra pods, if you can't use them, just by the way, pick them off anyway, drop them on the ground. Use them as mulch. Won't matter. You might get a few okra seeds coming up there next year, but it's not a big deal. That actually just happened to me several times, and it's not a big deal. You just pick that okra when it comes up. But you got to pick, and that's one of the challenges, but it's kind of fun, and it's kind of fun to play hide and seek, and it's kind of fun to think, gosh, this is my garden. This is producing all I can possibly eat. And then let's talk about cooking real briefly. And I, you know, gosh, I did start at the worst place, right? Because so many of you think you don't like okra, and it's partly because of the way you cook it. You know, for us, okra, if what you think of as French fries, you know how people eat French fries? We eat okra that way. Okra is our French fries. So what we do is you just simply, it's very good, you just put it in a pan, a big pan. You put it in the oven. You turn the temperature at about 375 degrees. If the pods are big, you can split them in half, put them in the pan. Don't put any oil in there to start with. That's my view. Don't start with oil. And just let them roast. About midway through, put a little oil on them, stir them around, stir them up. Delicious. Put a little salt on them before you eat them. Really great. That's how hard it is. And you can just, and it becomes like your French fries. It's addictive. It is absolutely addictive. And compared to French fries, gosh, the flavor is so good. And it's not, you know, all this stuff about slimy okra. I just hate to bring it up. It doesn't apply here. It just doesn't apply. I actually, I don't even mind boiling okra, but you don't want to boil it too hard because you lose all the flavor. And with this, you get great flavor. You know, the other thing with okra, I always have to remind people, is you don't even have to cook it. It's great raw. I'm in the garden. I'm hungry. I eat okra. I just pick it off the vine. I pick it off the... It's not a vine, is it? It's a thing. It's a shrub. It's a mini tree. I pick it off the mini tree, and I eat it just right there. It's good. It's delicious. It's wonderful. Doesn't hurt you. It's great. You can chop it up. You can put it in salads. And so one of, I think, our impediments to just using vegetables is that we need to come up with ways to use vegetables that are easy to do and that don't require a tremendous effort. And that's easy. I mean, we tend to make it too hard to cook things. Too hard to cook things. Putting them on the grill is great. And a lot of things really don't need to be cooked hard and long. They can be cooked quickly. I got these, you know, we got these Japanese peppers. I'm started. I'm on a roll. You're going to have to listen to this for a second. So we got these Japanese peppers. They're absolutely delicious. They're wonderful. They're great. And shishito kind of style peppers. And you know what they're great is because they're so easy to deal with. You know what I do? I pick them. I bring home. Oh, I stuff my pockets full of them. I got a big shirt pocket full of them. I got them in my pants pockets. I have to pull them loose from the keys when I take my pants off. And so I got all this stuff. I do this every now and then. So it's just, you got all these peppers. And you know what I do? I just throw them in a black skillet. I wash them first because they've been in my pockets. I wash them first. I throw them in the, I don't even dry them off. I just throw them in the black skillet. Black skillet gets hot. Black skillet's going to burn off all that excess water. They're going to start blistering. I take a little spatula. I stir them around a little bit. About halfway through the cooking process, not to get started, but about halfway through the cooking process, I throw some oil on there. It's going to sprinkle a little bit. It's going to, so just stand back. But put a little bit of oil. Don't put a lot, just a little bit. But mostly when they're nearly through cooking, just put a little bit of oil, and you can even take them off the heat at that point. Put the oil in. After they're good and blistered, put a little bit of oil in there. I put a little bit of sesame seed in there. Don't put it in there while it's still hot, because the sesame seeds are going to pop everywhere. I've learned this from experience. Let it, take it off of the eye. Put your sesame, just mix it all, stir it up. Put a little salt in there. Put a little soy sauce. Great. Wonderful things. You can just, they're so addictive. You can just eat them. Don't overcook them. You don't need to overcook them. They're so good. All these things are great. Basil. Man, have I talked about basil before? I know I have, because I think about it all the time. Like, I could eat basil 3 or 4 times a week. We're not talking about it as some little fancy condiment. It's a vegetable. It's an incredible vegetable. It's better for you than collards. That's my assessment. It is. It probably is. Most people just don't eat it as a vegetable, and it's really great. You can make a pesto out of it. You don't need a food processor to do that. You can just chop it up. In fact, one of the things I do, even if I'm using a food processor, which I have done, and I still will do occasionally, is you put part of your basil in there first, break it up. Don't just pulse it a few times. Don't turn it into mush. And then save part of your basil leaves and put them in there last so that they don't get cut up as much. It gives you that nice texture. You know, it really is nice. You can use it. You know, you don't have to use it on pasta. You can actually use it on your squash. Did I mention squash? We're going to talk about squash. We're going to talk with David Hubble. He's going to be here in a minute.
You can take all the tea in China, put it in a big brown bag for me, sail right round.
You get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
David Hubble is squeezing himself through the airwaves now, trying to get onto the station. We'll hear from him in just a second. We're going to talk a little bit about it. So a couple calls. Keith was greatly amused. I will say, Keith, that I have never washed a pepper in my pants pockets. I have, however, found okra that I washed in my pants pockets. I did not cook it afterwards. I don't think it improves the flavor. So, yeah, you got this problem when you're stuffing your pockets full of vegetables from the garden. There it is. Rusty says he's got olive oil and salt and pepper in the air fryer is better. Okra, olive oil, and salt and pepper in the air fryer is better than fried. And it is good. We had a bunch of okra, and we fried it the other night just for old time's sake. It was good. And we used I think part of the challenge there is getting a really good cornmeal with that. And it was good. I really loved it. But, you know, it's not for flavor, it's not better than putting it in the oven. And it's so simple. And frying it can take forever. If you know what I'm saying, it can just take a while when you're frying it traditionally with that big bunch of oil. But, man, it is so good. You know, I'll just say, too, I'm going to add, for a lot of dishes, you don't need, if you use a black skillet, one of the great, the great keystone of Southern cooking is that black skillet. If you use the black skillet, and even if you use carbon skillets, carbon steel skillets, just thinner steel, you don't have to put the oil in there to get started. And black skillets are really good about this. You just don't have to put the oil in there. And I don't recommend that. You don't want to leave the skillet bare, but if you've got vegetables in there, it's great that way. Just let it roast a little bit there, then put the oil in. That can also be good. It dries the skin out a little bit, gives it a little bit more texture. You don't want to overcook it that way either. Once you put the oil in there, it's going to cook a lot faster. But you don't have to use a lot of oil in any case. And I always let the skin dry out just a little bit first before I put the oil in. There's arguments both ways. David, what are you thinking? You there?
Hello.
Hey, there he is. David Hubble. David and I go way back, but all based on this show. David called in early a number of years ago. David, I can't even remember how long I've been doing this show, 15 years, I think. Mm-hmm. And you called in early on. We were talking about Louisiana vegetables and melaton. But David is a great experimenter with vegetables, and particularly traditional vegetables that we tended to forget about here on the Gulf Coast because we don't really know where we are. We don't remember where we came from. And we have in mind that the only vegetables that are out there are the vegetables that we get at Walmart, which is wrong. So, David, did you try anything new this year?
Not really. I'm just maybe a different variety of okra, which I just can't remember right now which one it was, but it was an old heirloom. I got from a guy in Louisiana. I can't remember where he got it from, but this one has been pretty prolific. I only had, because I've been doing it in raised beds and the shade problem that continues around my yard, only about four of the plants took. But, I mean, every 2 days or so, it seems like I'm picking pod off of those, and I've easily gotten about 2 pounds just from those small amounts. So I've been really pleased with it, and I haven't really tasted it yet because usually what I'll do is I'll save a pound to make gumbo, like we've talked about in the past. But then I've got enough extra at this point now. I'm trying to consider what to do. And actually, a cousin of mine called me yesterday. She's got a project, and she wanted to come up with a bunch of different okra recipes that were kind of off the beaten path because she's trying to do another thing and trying to see, you know, what else is out there. How else did we eat okra? And so actually, it was funny. I looked up a bunch of them yesterday. But
yeah,
anyway,
cool.
So... Go ahead.
Yeah, so it really is the if you're like David and you're space constrained because of shade, it's good to pick a productive variety of okra. I'm experimenting with several. Some have been very productive this year, and some new ones that I tried, I'm gonna evaluate them a little bit more and then talk about them. But I do think if you're space constrained, it can be good. Some were very productive, but didn't taste as good. And there's a lot of difference in okra taste. I find some are pretty mild, but I actually like the taste of okra. It's really quite good, and it's I want to have a little bit. It's a very distinct. How would you describe the flavor of okra itself? Mm. What is that flavor? It's not really like anything else, but
no,
it's not
no,
too
I'm...
far out in left field either. I mean, it's really, really good. It just tastes like okra.
Right. I mean, I guess the thing that really puts people off is, like you were talking earlier, is the mouthfeel, if you will, the sliminess that people associate with okra. But I think if you look at it a lot of different ways, you'll find that there's ways to prepare it that will kind of reduce that issue, and you'll get the true okra essence. Pickled okra, when it's in that acid.
Oh, gosh, I love pickled okra.
So, I mean, you get that flavor, and, unlike some other vegetables that are maybe too strong, I think you're kind of right. It's got a mild enough flavor and more pronounced than, say, something like Melitol, but it's got its own flavor. And I kind of, usually when it's cooking, especially when I'm making gumbo and it's cooking, that's when you can smell it kind of come to the forefront, if you will.
Right.
And I think that's what a lot of people will associate. That's why you associate it with gumbo, because of the name. And
you can, I can smell that gumbo smell. That is the okra smell now. I'm smelling it right now. Of course, there's different gumbo smells because there's different gumbos.
Right.
But I can smell the gumbo that my aunt made that had that okra in it, and it was really good.
Mm-hmm.
Great smell. It's interesting. You know, I would say it's interesting how to reduce the sliminess. The problem is that our cooking methods actually increase the sliminess. So
right.
And so if you don't use these weird cooking methods that increase the sliminess, you're not going to get that. But just roasting them in the roasting okra in the oven, you're not going to get that. Eating okra raw, it's not slimy at all. It tastes, it's really good, and it's crunchy and delicious, and it has a great smell. There's a smell I associate with okra, particularly fresh, that is so distinctive. And I love it. It gets on your hands a little bit, and I love to smell my hands afterwards because it's such a neat smell, and I love that smell. It just smells great.
The point you were talking about, like with the fried okra, I think what I found is that you really want a cornmeal as your a crispy kind of cornmeal as opposed to corn flour. I think that makes it that helps. To me, it adds to that flavor of the okra when it's fried. It complements
it. And my wife used a purple corn meal that we got from a mill out of Birmingham that's really coarse, but really held up well and was just perfect. It was really gave it just that right amount of crunch. It didn't burn as easily as flours. And if you use a flour, I think it's going to burn more easily than if you use a cornmeal. So all that's important in terms of your fried okra. And then, of course, as I'm sure you know, and a lot of people may not know, the part of the secret to cooking fried okra is not to turn it too much. you let it just sit there, and then about sometime in there you turn it. But it takes a while. It's just gonna flat take a while to fry okra. Well, we're gonna end up talking about nothing but okra. So, how does your squash look this year?
Well, the
and your squash like gugusa.
Well, the vine is going wild now, but I've only got one that is coming to maturity. I think once again with the sunlight issue, as soon as that vine has crept out into that sunlight, I'm seeing tons of flowers. And so usually this is when I get it, and this is a little different variety than I've grown in the past, but I've got a nice about 2.5 foot one on there right now, so probably the end of this week I'll be picking it. And I usually make a nice little casserole with it, with some Italian sausage and cheese and tomatoes. So that's what I'm looking forward to in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. So that would be, and that's great. So I do think that's a perfect kind of way to think about the casserole with the tomatoes. Are your did you grow unusual varieties of tomatoes this year?
I did unusual as in the heirlooms that I got from Louisiana.
Right.
Louisiana Reds, Pink, I think they're called Dixies, and Gulf State. I did those usual ones, but it seemed like I did okay, and then about midway it seemed like everything just kind of petered out. So once again, I'm not sure whether we had some change in other sunlight issues around here too, and I was out of town part of the time, so... But it was enough for me to enjoy, but not as much as I had in the past.
Yeah. You know, David, I keep experimenting with vegetables, and this is one that is, I will tell you, it's not traditional to the Gulf Coast, at least in this part of the Gulf Coast. But in Mexico, it's quite common, and like melaton, and, you know, it's a ancient Caribbean connection, the ancient Gulf connection between all of those South American mm-hmm. countries and New Orleans and Mobile that brought us things like melaton. But this is a cosmos. You know, we think of cosmos as a flowering plant,
mm-hmm.
and that's pretty. But as it turns out, I mean, I've heard of people eating the flowers, but it turns out that one type of cosmos, which is called, you sometimes see it sold as king salad, it's now grown around the world in mostly tropical places, but it's really good, and I'll come back and talk about it in just a minute. I think you might want to look into it and see if we've got any history of it on the upper Gulf Coast. We'll be back in just a minute.
All right.
Have you ever seen peaches grow on creeping feet of vine?
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. David Hubble is here with me. David is increasingly well known for his work with Louisiana vegetables and sort of resurrecting Louisiana cooking traditions that are based on not what you find in the grocery store, but what people traditionally ate. So we've had conversations about thistles, and thistles is a good introduction, because thistles, David, are a member of this aster family. They're a member of the larger mm-hmm. aster family, and it's and they're like artichokes in that and cardoons and many other things that we eat there, but we don't eat that many asters. For whatever crazy reason, and they're actually all quite good, and a lot of them, they have a very distinctive and very pleasant flavor that is that I really like. It is distinctive. And so this Cosmos, and I'm just going to tell David about it. It's something we ought to think about. This Cosmos that I tried, which is sometimes called King Salad. I found it available from several places on the internet. Cosmos caudatus is the Latin name. And it is delicious. And so we've been eating it for greens. And so when I cook my beans, rather than spice them up with other things, I just mix in as towards the end, as the beans are, I parboil my beans just briefly in the water that I'm going to make the rice or whatever in, and then stir fry them the rest of the way, and then put these greens in there with a little oil and might add a few drops of, say, local muscadine wine or something, which can really, but it's delicious, and they've been really great, and they've really been good. It's like a spice all its own, but the vegetables are good and they're great for you. So our challenge is to see what our ancestors ate in terms of Aster family members.
Okay.
Likes, not just sunflowers, which are one type, and what kind of native sunflowers did we use, but things like thistles and also things like cosmos, which are native to Mexico and have been exported around the world. But we're probably part of this Caribbean food tradition that we're talking about a lot.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I know that I can't think of a whole lot of Louisiana traditions with the flowers, but I haven't dug back far enough. I know one I did, which was with camellias, when I made that camellia wine a few years back, which was just basically steeping it in brandy and it made it basically a cordial type of thing. But I know, like, recently when we went to Disney World, a lot of the food they had nice edible flowers on top of the
right.
dishes. So, definitely I think it's something that people would be interested in, as long as we can figure out the connection. And the way you described especially with the enhancement to the beans, sounds really good.
It's really good. So actually, it's not the flowers, it's just the leaves. And in this
case,
the leaves. So some of the cosmos are eaten for flowers, and you could eat this one for flowers, but...
Oh, that's right.
But it's the leaves that are so good, and they're actually quite good. And you know, it's like with the thistle, it's not that we're eating the flower, it's that we're eating the stalk. And it's the stalk that's so good. And the flower is an artichoke that's probably not going to be worth trying to pull apart, tease apart. But the stem is quite good, like a cardoon. So it's really interesting. And I think that probably, I think sunflowers, you know, sunflowers, we do tend to think of eating the seeds, but I suspect that a lot of sunflowers were eaten for the stems or for the leaves. We think of the flowers or the seeds, but they were eaten for the stems or the leaves or for the roots, in the case of what we now call Jerusalem artichoke, which in fact is not an artichoke at all, and not from Jerusalem, but is a Native American plant that is native to Alabama, and the roots are eaten, and the roots can be quite good. They have a lot of inulin sugar in them, and are widely eaten, and were widely eaten in pre-Columbian times. But I wonder what else we're missing. So what else are you experimenting with cooking while we've got a little bit of time left?
Well, I hadn't done as much as I had hoped to this year. I did remember something that I am growing in the garden that I hadn't tried was the lima beans, the snow on the mountain, the purple with the little white,
cool.
Two color I got from the John Conkendall collection. He got those from Washington Parish. I haven't gotten enough yet to really cook them down, but it goes back to the artichoke, actually. One of the things we did is this artichoke squares, which is, it's a little more prefabricated because of the fact we used canned hearts. But you chop that up and you mix it with Italian breadcrumbs and Parmesan cheese and olive oil and lemon juice, and you basically make kind of a thick kind of paste, and you bake it in the oven And if you've ever had a stuffed artichoke, it's like the stuffed artichoke, but in servable little appetizers. So
yeah.
you could probably do a little less processing than the way I do it. But I mean, I imagine if you had some good homemade rough bread and had enough artichoke hearts, or even something, some of those like stems like you were talking about from some of the other vegetables, you could create something very similar. So it's kind of like, it's not quite like cornbread, but it has a consistency like of a somewhere between a casserole and a bread type like that.
Yeah. I can see that. That would be really interesting. You know, it reminds me of artichokes, and we spent this period of time when I spent a lot of time looking through Louisiana recipes and realizing that artichokes have a long history in New Orleans. Am I correct about that? I mean, aren't you seeing it show
right.
up in 19th century recipes?
Right. And, the Creole Italians had a big influence, I think, with that.
Yeah, and so I got to thinking, you know, how do we find these artichoke varieties that would do well for us? New Orleans has a slightly better climate than Mobile for growing artichokes, and Mobile has a much better climate than, say, Huntsville or Birmingham for growing artichokes, because you basically have to overwinter them to really
right.
do well. But I think they must have planted them annually. Do you think that's the case, that they would plant them annually maybe this time of year? And then how do you think that was done?
I think you're probably right. I've also seen people maybe try them in bigger pots and bring them outside. There was a Creole variety listed, but I haven't been able to find the source for it, so I'm still looking.
Well, we got to find that one. David, it's good to talk, man. We're just getting started. We'll have to do this again soon. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for calling in.